When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Fantasy. I'm your host, A.E. Lanier. Today, I will be speaking with Aparna Verma about her new novel, The Phoenix King. The novel takes place in the desert kingdom of Provence as war brews on its borders and as the king is about to step down. The story follows an assassin exiled but struggling to return home, as well as both the king and the heir to the throne. This is Aparna's debut novel, and she is here with us now. Hi, Aparna. It's great to have you.
Hello. Thank you for having me on the show.
Could you start with telling us a little bit about The Phoenix King and just how that story came about for you?
So The Phoenix King, I've been kind of playing with the idea of the book for over 13 years. and it evolved over time, of course, but I didn't really get serious, quote unquote, about the book until March 2020, when, you know, we were all locked in and there was nothing really else to do. So I thought, you know what, I'm just gonna write the damn book at this point. Cause it was just nibbling away in my mind. So I started it off as more of an exploration of like all the darkness that we were seeing in the world, specifically how political leaders were manipulating emotions, politics, religion to, you know, put their own political agendas forward, you know, for their own political gain. And that's something that the Phoenix King really grapples with, specifically religion, and how religion can be used as a tool and a weapon sometimes, despite it being also a resource. I give solace to people who believe. And so all the characters have a complicated relationship with their faith. Some believe in it. Some believe in it because of tradition, because of homeland, because they were taught to believe in it. Some people used to believe and then learn better or learn worse, depending on your point of view. So you see their journeys of grappling with their faith, and how some of them try to break away to quote unquote get freedom, to say like, I will not let fate or destiny or the gods control my journey on, you know, in this world, while others kind of buy into or believe that, you know, what these gods are doing is something that is holy, that the world needs, and I draw power from that. I draw stability from that. I draw peace from that. And so I just find faith and religion to be very interesting, and how different people, individuals, interact with it and in relationships with it. So you see that in The Phoenix King for sure.
So yeah, absolutely. Religion is sort of at the heart of this, and those different and changing relationships to faith are super central for really all of our main characters.
Yes.
Government is also a really important part. Monarchy specifically, we have two people that are members of the royal family. The third was essentially like a child soldier that was raised to overturn monarchy. And there's a lot of conversation about monarchy specifically as a government system. Can you talk a little bit about that and its role in the book?
Yeah. So the Kingdom of Provence basically operates with a religious throne. And in that it's believed that the royal family comes from this, you know, long lineage from the founder of the kingdom. And that founder was blessed by the power of the Phoenix, their god, to uphold this throne. And the history of the world is that the Phoenix has a prophet, and in the last coming of the prophet burned down the sinners and made Provence, which was once a beautiful, bountiful forest, into a desert. And this happened, you know, over centuries. It didn't happen overnight. And their founder, the original Provence, the original Govandi, he came in and made a home in the desert. And so his followers finally found peace because his God was able to protect them from all the warring kingdoms. So it was almost like a haven for them, where they could, you know, practice their faith of the phoenix without being, like, you know, persecuted. Because at that time, if you believe in the phoenix, you believe in their vengeful, destructive prophet who had basically killed everyone beforehand. So and Leo and Alina come from this idea of, like, you know, we were blessed by the God. That's why we are ruling. And we come into the book at a time where Alina must now rise to power. She's about to be 25 sons. It's tradition. And we see Leo, her father, not coming to terms that he has to give up his power, that he has to give up the throne. And then it's his child. So, of course, he feels, you know, it happened to him. His father had put down the throne to him. But you feel a little bit of resistance on his part. And he cloaks it behind, I need to protect this kingdom because a new prophecy came that a new prophet's coming. So he hides behind layers of so-called politics and religion, so his daughter, to distance himself from his daughter and not necessarily give her the keys and the reins to the throne. Like, he's trying his hardest, like, no, I need to be here. I need to guide you. Because without me, you won't be able to run this kingdom.
That succession strategy where the monarch changes not because the old king dies, but because the heir reaches a certain age is really unusual and was really interesting and complicated that father-daughter relationship a lot as well in really engaging ways. Can you speak about that decision to make the throne work that way?
Yeah, so I think it's overdone sometimes in fantasy of, like, oh, the old king is dead or he got murdered and assassinated. So here you go. Here's, like, the next, you know, person on the butcher's block, aka the throne. So I wanted to change it a little bit of, like, you know, living in the States, and, you know, we live in a democracy where, like, either the president, you know, at most can only serve 8 years, two terms, 8 years, and then you're done, you're out. And I wondered, like, what if we apply that to a monarchy? But of course, we're going to need a little bit more time. You can't just do 8 years of new king. Like, that would be a little too much. So I thought, you know, until the heir turns 25 years of age. So it's not necessarily you rule for 25 years. It's whenever you have that kid, the time starts ticking. The timer starts ticking. So it's complicated in, like, how the rulers kind of time when they have their kids. Like, Leo has his kid, like, later on, has Alina later on. He only has one child, which is purposeful, so he didn't have bickering children to fight over the throne. But I think, in a way, it makes it more complicated and interesting, as for me as a writer, because you have a tradition where, like, okay, this person that I'm going to take this throne, and this heir who has been bred, basically, to know politics, to know the religion of the world, to basically be born and raised to do this one job, and you are resisting that. You are resisting the culture and the traditions that you say you uphold of your kingdom, that you are the shining beacon of. But personally, you're resisting. You don't want her to take the throne quite yet because you don't want to be deemed, not useful. And so for me, that I wanted to make that 25 term of the heir because I wanted that conflict of Alina and Leo to really, you know, raise the stakes of, like, will he actually give the throne to her? Will she actually take the throne and, you know, assume power? Or, you know, will Leo continue to resist and not teach her, you know, the promise of the throne, which is how to wield fire?
So Alina is very concerned about taking power, about fire, which we'll get to in a bit. But she also is, during this, becoming engaged as well and is thinking about royal marriage and basically, like, continuing this line, which is something that's necessary if you're going to have a hereditary sort of leadership. But I feel like a lot of times in U.S. stories, we treat that responsibility with, like, a lot of contempt or we dismiss it. So it was interesting to see a young monarch that is, like, also thinking about, or a young, like, up-and-coming monarch who's also thinking about the next line and, like, getting married and all that stuff. Can you talk a little bit about royal engagement?
Yeah. So I, you know, the Phoenix King is Indian inspired. And I think when the West thinks about Indian stories, what or thinks about India in general, there's always like the topic of arranged marriages just come up. They just often do. I remember growing up as a kid when we, you know, in world history class in sixth grade, when we learned about India, my friends would ask me, are you going to get an arranged marriage? Like, once they learned that arranged marriage was a concept, like, I would always get asked that. Throughout school, like, once they found out my parents had arranged marriage, they're like, this is so beyond my own my Western understanding of, like, love and marriage. Like, does this actually work? Like, do you guys hate each other? Like, you know? And so I think arranged marriages, you know, have their, you know, their pros and cons, and it's a very individual, you know, on the relationship and the couple. But I wanted to thwart that Western thinking of like the arranged marriage, or oh, poor girl, like she is locked into this marriage with like an older guy who is going to misuse her and mistreat her, and this is the end of her life, you know, because she was forced into a political marriage. In which she had no say or decision, and like the classical poor Indian arranged marriage bride did not want to do that in the Phoenix King. And I wanted Aaliyah to have that agency of like picking her suitor. So, I mean, Leo brings forth like this is, you know, Samson, like, you know, he is like almost like a military king in a way. But at the end of the day, Aaliyah is the one who takes that decision, because there's multiple suitors who have come and went. But she makes a very calculated decision to say yes to Samson because of his relationship with their with the antagonist, King Farin of Janthar, and his army. So she was very political and strategic in saying yes to Samson. And I wanted her to like have fun. I wanted her to flirt. I wanted her to like understand like that this is all for her kingdom. But at the end of the day, that's what Aaliyah operates on. It's that because she has been born and bred to serve her kingdom, her kingdom is a part of her identity. Without Robbins, she is not Aaliyah Adia Robbins. It's literally her name, you know? And so when she takes on Samson as her suitor, she immediately puts, you know, makes it known that she is the ruler. She is the one in power over him. But she's going to enjoy it. Like, you know, she is not like some sad, you know, princess who's been, you know, married off to this like handsome suitor. Is like, no, I'm gonna have fun with you, I'm gonna tease you, I'm gonna flirt with you, I'm gonna let you know that I'm the one in power. So just wanted to change it up a little bit.
And it is very clear that she's still definitely gonna be the one in charge. We have, like, I guess the phrase that might sometimes be used is more modern gender roles, although what that even means, but this is very much a science fantasy, right? There is magic, and there are also like hover cars. There's like melee combat, and also lots of future techie things. Can you talk a little bit about that decision to make this sort of more of a science fantasy than a traditional fantasy?
Yeah, well, I think the present moment, like even though like our present moment is a blend of the past and the future, like we are talking on StreamYard right now in two different places. You're in North Carolina, I'm in Texas, and we have iPhones, we have laptops, we have electric cars, and yet we still stick to the same religions that date back centuries. I'm a practicing Hindu. That has been practiced for centuries. It's an age-old tradition and religion, and it made me start thinking of, like, you know, if humans were to progress forward, we would still keep our own faith. We will keep our religions that, you know, date back for centuries, or we're going to create new ones. But we will always have faith and a religion to go to. So that made me ask the question of, like, what if we were in a super, you know, futuristic desert kingdom ruled by a religious throne? What happens then? Like, you know, and so I wanted to see that blend of, like, you know, of Indian sci-fi. Also, we don't get a lot of Indian sci-fi. When we see sci-fi, it's like mostly like white characters. So I was like, you know what? I want to do Indian sci-fi. Also, Star Trek used a lot of Indian clothing, like the gurdas. I was like, hello, that's from us. And so it's really funny. This is kind of an aside, but one of the art prints that's part of the book, that's part of the epilogue, someone saw it and they said, is this from Star Wars? I was like, no, he's wearing a sherwani. Like, that's literally from India. But Star Wars co-opted some of this stuff, so like it looks like it's Star Wars. So that's an aside. So I really wanted to blend, you know, the future and the past, because we see it in our present day moment, but I just wanted to turn it up a notch by making it like, you know, there's like hover trains and holopods, but there's also sling swords and game suits. And I just love like the concept of the game field. And that's something that I'm playing with a lot more in like book two and, you know, later on in the series.
So we definitely have like lots of very fun tech. There's also magic, and a lot of the magic, just like a lot of sort of the culture, is centered in fire, which is both like magically significant, culturally significant. These things obviously feed each other. Could you talk a little bit about why you decided to make fire so central and sort of the role that it plays in this story?
Yeah, so fire has duality, and that's what has always piqued my interest. Fire is both necessary for destruction, but also for rebirth. Think of a forest, right? Like, we learned this in like sixth grade ecology. Like, you know, we learned from the very beginning that a forest fire burns the underbrush of, you know, of a forest that allows new life to grow forth. That's why some firefighters in like, you know, controlled environments create forest fires on purpose to help aid the forest in growth. In Hinduism, one of our, you know, Vedic gods is Agni. And Agni is a word that comes from Sanskrit, and it means, you know, it means a fire god. And Agni is said to have two faces. One of destruction, like one of like that's scary and like, you know, gruesome and like, you know, makes you want to hide underneath your bed. And the other one is welcoming. It's warm. It's like all the happy things that fire makes you think of, like marshmallows, being around the campfire, telling stories. And so when I was thinking about the religion and like using fire as a motif for the kingdom of Ravans, I really associated with the phoenix. Hinduism doesn't really have a phoenix per se, though if you look at like the linguistic and more of like the historical roots, Garuda, who is our man eagle god, he's like the king of the birds, has similar associations with the phoenix. It's said in the Mahabharata that he, you know, was born in an egg with like a very, very bright light, like shining intense light. And when that light comes, it means it's the start of the end of the cosmic, it's the start of the end, which means cosmic destruction is about to happen for this era to end on earth and a new one to come. And I was like, that's a phoenix. Rebirth, destruction, the cycle over and over again. And so when Alina tries to learn about fire and holding fire, she has to come to terms of like what fire really means. There's this misconception that the characters hold in the books of that the phoenix is a vengeful god. You know, that fire is destructive. You see that a lot of in Yasin's, in his chapters, because he was raised to believe that the phoenix is terrible. It's a sham religion, you know, being like a part of the aura of the scene. But through Alina's perspective and through her connection with her mother, who was a devotee of the phoenix, and Alina, to hold on to her mother's relationship, she continues worshiping the phoenix because it reminds her of her mother. And I think like, and that's personal to me, because I feel like I became more devout or more of like interested in Hinduism after I left for college. Actually, after I left my family, because it was my connection to home. And that's similar for Alina. It's her connection to her mother. And in that, she learns that fire isn't just destructive. It's a memory. It's that warmth. It's that love. And so, you know, of all the other elements, I think fire is like, is the one that perfectly captures that duality of being both destructive but also nurturing.
You mentioned as well Alina's mother, who died when she's quite young. So that means that both she has lost her mother and Leo has lost his partner. So despite the fact that she dies long before the book starts, she's very much a presence in this story. She's also quite an important scholar. Could you talk a little bit about that character and the role that she plays in the story?
Yeah, I love Anna. I think of all the characters, and this is like, I just love tragedies, but of all the characters, I feel like I'm mostly associated with her. I was like, yeah, I would love to dive with my books. Why not? Like, you know. But I love Anna as a character, and you know, one, because she is a beacon of warmth and stability for Alina, who lost her mother, like you said, at a very young age. But also, I think she shows Leo's tragedy. You know, before Leo died, he very much, when Anna was alive, he very much took advice from her. Like, he took solace from her. Like, she was his partner in crime, you know, quote unquote. And he respected her, and she softened his edges in a way, and was able to keep him balanced. And it's when she died, and he, without giving a spoiler away, realizes why she died, that's when he starts to veer away from the religion of the Phoenix. That's when we start to see the down path. And I think that's a tragedy because, again, when we talk about fate, sometimes it's not centered on the religion of the god, it's centered on a person. And for Leo, his faith was in Anna. And so when Anna dies, it's correlated that his faith in the Phoenix also slowly dies. Because she was his stability point. When she's gone, he's like, the reason she died was because of the Phoenix. So I am no longer, you know, a believer. I will take the motions of pretending to believe because I'm the king. Like, I am forced in a way to pretend I'm a believer, to pretend that I, you know, uphold the throne because of this, you know, this fantastical fire. But really, he realizes, like, no, it's all a sham. It's all a show. But I will continue the show because that is my role as king. And it hurts that belief is gone, I think, for him. Because if it had been, maybe he would have been a gentler king, you know?
Absolutely. There's also, at the beginning of basically every chapter, one of those really fun specfic things, which is you've got an epigraph of documents from the world. Can you talk a little bit about your inclusion of fake primary sources?
Oh, I love it. So, you know what's really funny? A reader actually DM'd me saying, like, I Googled these texts thinking that they were real things, and I realized, oh my god, you made them all up? I was like, yes. I have a whole library of textbooks from this world. I love epigraphs in a way of, like, I think they're a good tool for world building. Like, it gives you, like, just instantaneously, like, oh, this is what the Jandari Times thinks about the Kingdom of Robots, you know? And I was, you know, a journalist for a brief period of time. I worked at my college newspaper. My first job out of college was at a financial news team. And I realized really quickly journalism wasn't for me. I am leaving. But it really, I think being a journalist has really formed my way and perspective as a fiction writer. One, in that primary sources, I love including primary sources in fiction worlds because you're like, oh, it's fiction. Everything is fake, you know, like it's all made up. So let me make it. But when you add a primary source, it adds almost like a degree of credibility in a way of like showing like the I think the vastness of the world. Like one of the texts is the Great History of Seon, and you learn about the different nations, the beyond Ravans and Jundar. Like when you look at the map in the book, you're like, oh my gosh, there's like two continents, and like there's all these other kingdoms that we've heard about, but we're, you know, we'll see later on in the trilogy. But you see a little bit in the epigraphs. I also think they're a really good foreshadowing. Like I believe in like leaving Easter eggs for the close reader, because I just feel like it's fun. I was an English major, and I love when I close read. I feel like I was like having a secret into the conversation with the writer. So like even the first epigraph on Yatsen chapter one, where the king said to his people, "We are the chosen," and the people responded, "Chosen by whom?" You know, and it's this idea of like who chooses us. Like, who has that power? Is it a god? Is it a person? Is it you? And it really goes into, it, you know, goes into the letter that we later see in the book that I'm not going to talk about without giving a spoiler. But I think, like, a lot of the trilogy also centers about chosen by whom. But that's at the very first of the novel. And I wanted to leave that there for, like, the close reader of, like, just like, you know, wink, wink, look back at this when you read book two and book three, because it's going to apply of like chosen by whom. Yeah, I think it's just fun to like do world building, but also like give little nuggets to like the close reader, like, aha, you were paying attention here, you know?
Absolutely. Revanse is a desert nation, as we've mentioned before, and deserts are just like really an important part of this story. They're important to a lot of our characters and their self-conception. Can you talk a little bit about the decision to set this in a desert?
Yeah, so I was born in Rajasthan, India. And Rajasthan is the desert state in India. And I feel like throughout my life, I've always had a deep spiritual connection to the desert. It has that duality of also like fire. Like, you know, like when you think of the desert, you think of just a dry, arid landscape. You don't think life is really teeming in the desert. But when you look closer, you realize actually the desert is full of life. There's, you know, and depending on what kind of deserts you go to, there's so many different species and animals and people who carve a living in there. And so for me, it was in a way paying homage to Rajasthan. Which I love. Rajasthan literally means land of the kings. And I wanted to bring in that duality of the desert because I think, it's just poetic, it's spiritual, it's very personal to me. But like you said, each character has their own personal conception of the desert and how I feel like the desert almost is its own character, like, you know, to be like, you know, like cliche, like the landscape and its own character. But I think it really speaks for itself. And it's very much ingrained of like how Alina operates for sure.
This is your debut. We already talked about a lot of the really fun things that are in this story. Is there anything that we haven't covered yet so far that you like definitely were excited to put in this book or to include?
Oh, the little Bollywood Easter eggs. I am a romantic at heart. I feel like I am definitely a romantic at heart. And as I've grown older, I've come to accept that. But I love Shah Rukh Khan movies. Like, I grew up on his movies. And there's this iconic scene. It's been done in different of his movies. But there's one in Kabhi Khushi Kabhi Gham, which is like one of my favorite movies, where there's like a dance sequence and he is dancing with the love interest Kajol, who actually some people on the internet said I look like her, and I will take that as a compliment because she is gorgeous. And she is running past him at the end of her dupatta, which is basically like this long, beautiful embroidered scarf, gets stuck on the end of his kurta. And you get this like moment where he raises his sleeve, and they're kind of like, they have this heated moment of like gazing into each other. This also happens in Om Shanti Om with Shah Rukh Khan again and Deepika Padukone. And so I was like, I've always lived for these moments. Let me add it into my book because I can. And so there's this moment of a dance sequence, of course, where Alina and Yasin are dancing. They're practicing. She's practicing her coronation dance for the coronation ball because we got to have a ball. And as he lifts her up and lowers her down, she's trying to turn away and her dupatta gets stuck on the end of his uniform. And you have this little charged moment of like his heart is hammering as she touches his wrists and their eyes connect. And I was like, chef's kiss. That is my homage to Bollywood and SRK. So if you are a Bollywood lover, you will hopefully love that moment. And it's illustrated, which will be revealed on release day. So very excited to show that.
That is extraordinarily exciting. This book has so much in it. It's a lot of fun. We've really just scratched the surface. And it comes out on August 29th, so Tuesday. So there's a very good chance that it is either out when you're listening to this or will be out in just a day or two. Very excited to let the world see this one. I have been speaking with Aparna Verma about her debut novel, The Phoenix King, out, as I said, August 29th from Orbit. Thank you so much for listening, and please consider supporting us by subscribing, leaving a review, telling a friend, all that good stuff. I will speak to you soon, and for now, happy reading.